City. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on Progressive Radio Network on Monday, October 29th, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network every Monday live from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember that our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
Today you're going to hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 through the hour. And we've got another fantastic show for you today that's going to include, should standard medical guidelines be questioned?
Oh, and can chemotherapy benefits be overestimated?
By patients and both by doctors. And can epidural injections for back pain cause fractures?
And what helps seniors to live longer and have better quality lives?
And is there something that really works for hot flashes? You'll find out.
And if you'd like to join in our conversation and have questions about our topics or your health, give us a call on Mondays from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time or 10 to 11 Eastern Time on PRN.FM at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. All this stuff about the Proposition 37
in California.
That's getting to be so annoying because they keep all the big companies like Monsanto and DuPont are putting out these big, huge ads that are falsified and with quotes and things that are not true. And they're trying to get everybody to vote no instead of voting yes. And it's just misinformation and it's not true. And
well, do you think we have the right to know what's in our food? If you think we have the right to, vote yes. If you think we don't have the right to, get your head examined because there's something wrong with that.
And just because they're saying that not everything's going to be labeled, it's a start. We want to get the GMOs on the labels. We need to know what's in our food. And California has a really important job right now because it's setting a standard for the whole United States.
That's right.
You know, some of the things that they're saying that aren't true is they're saying that the FDA says labeling is misleading.
Well, I mean, labeling generally is misleading, but you're right. It's giving us a lot more information about is there GMO in here or not.
And they're also trying to say that it's going to cost more money.
Well, I don't think that's true.
Well, it says your grocery bills are going to go up. Well, that's because they're going to have to repackage and write down new ingredients. And they say it's going to cost the customer $400 a year. Well, you know what? All the companies have to change their labels about every 18 months anyway. And that's when it's going to take effect if people do
vote
yes.
Well, think about what it's going to cost you if you're taking in all this GMO and what seems to be the case with the side effects of it are true.
They're suppressing all the health effects of the GMO. Remember what happened several years ago? They were firing employees and whole groups of scientists who exposed some of the problems like organ damage and reproductive problems and digestive problems.
This is just cold-hearted business.
Cancer.
And it's just cold-hearted business.
So anyway, we need to vote yes on Proposition 37. Yes, yes, yes. Tell everybody yes.
Yeah, really. It's crazy to do anything different than that. If you have a different opinion about that, please do call in.
Yeah, we're happy to talk about it because, you know, we're getting close to the gate.
That's right.
It's almost November. So where do medical guidelines and standards for doctors and health insurance companies and court decisions come from? Are they based on science or theory? So we're going to talk about that if there's a conflict of interest.
Oh, obviously there is. And everybody everywhere is developing guidelines where there's no real quality control. They're built on opinion and very weak data. If you look at the Institute of Medicine, which is part of the National Academy of Sciences, they've got 18 criteria that they use to determine whether or not something along the lines of a guideline are right in what we should be doing. They looked at 130 different guidelines that are available, and they found that fewer than half of those guidelines met even 10 or more of the standards that the Institute of Medicine came up with. And they published this in an article in Archives of Internal Medicine just this month, this October. So we've got a real issue on our hands here because what it's telling us is that the things your doctor are recommending for you are built on flimsy evidence that a lot of the time are built more on, does this work to provide a better income for my practice or is this something that's going to make me a better doctor and make better guidelines for my patients?
Is it for the patient or for business?
Right.
Well, so what's the criteria for publishing this stuff in the medical journals?
Well, I mean, you can do what you want there. The doctors get together, they form policy, and that policy is dictated on what they think is the best thing for patients and what, at least at some level of consciousness, is best for them in terms of making an income.
The problem is, I guess, is that so much of this is flawed and it's not based on science. It's just proclamations and theory and opinions.
Exactly.
So it's not trustworthy.
Well, it becomes the law, Vicki. That's a strange thing because, see, malpractice is determined by local standards. You don't follow the local standards, whether they're right or wrong. You've got a problem if something goes wrong, and the medical board gets involved with it. So you can wind up getting fined. You can lose your license. You can go to jail for things that are not right.
You know, and too, we've talked before about how much of the material that they put in the journals is based on science. You know, we need to take a look at this again because doctors look at the journals as the holy grail, and this is how they're trying to keep up with what's new in medicine.
You're so right. I mean, a lot of them, they read the abstract of the article, see what it says, and then they go by that as though it's some kind of fact. And what we have to keep in mind is that when you're reading an article, you have to figure out who is it that wrote that article, and could they possibly have a conflict of interest? And when you look at what's published, I mean, look at what Marcia Angel, the doctor from Harvard, she was affiliated with the New England Journal of Medicine for about 20 years, and for the last couple of years was the editor-in-chief of the journal. Very prestigious and powerful job. She quit her job, like Vicki said, saying that she couldn't stand watching the low quality of articles come across her desk and get into her journal. And so, I mean, that's just an awful thing. And then Catherine DeAngelis of the Journal of the American Medical Association has written a lot about that, although she hasn't quit her job. She's still there. And people from the Journal of Clinical Investigation, same thing. Ushma Neal, chief editor of that, quit a few years ago saying she couldn't stand the low quality of stuff coming across her desk and getting into the journals. So what percentage of what we're seeing in those journals is actually good science? That number, if you ask most doctors, they'll say, oh, it must be 90% or 95%. It's probably 98% because we've got good scientists here that must be doing the right thing, right?
I remember one time when you told them what the answer was, they were like wanting to shoot the messenger.
Well, I can't blame them. I was giving a talk to the oncologists and trying to convince them that they should be more open-minded about the therapies they use. So we got together, there were about 20 of them and me, and I knew what they were going to do. They're going to come out and say, well, you know, we are based in science, but you are based on just stuff that may be true and maybe not true, but it's not good science. So I said, well, let's take a look at that question. So we did, and the Office of Technology Assessment came up with the answer. And again, they thought it was 90-95% accurate. And I said, well, I hate to tell you this, but don't shoot the messenger. You know, I'm just reporting this. And by the way, here's the journal article. You can read it if you want. It says that the amount of good medicine that's published in our medical journals is 1%. And I have to admit, that staggered me too, because I couldn't believe it. I thought, how could that happen? We've got all these good scientists. But the question is, who's publishing them? And the National Institutes of Health, which has got its problems, publishes about a third of the articles that come out, and or at least is responsible for funding them. And when you look at the pharmaceutical industry, they're funding twice as much. So they've got about $90 billion they put in research every year. The National Institutes of Health has about $32 billion a year. So now you begin to see that you're not going to find a pharmaceutical company coming out and saying, well, we've got this drug here. We spent $750 million on it. And gee, it's too bad, but it doesn't work. You don't see that kind of honesty.
We sure need more editorial control. And the medical journals need to meet at least the Institute of Medicine standards.
Oh, I think that's the very minimum thing. So, I mean,
well, what's going on here is that a lot of the doctors are overprescribing tests. and there's a conflict of interest, like, for example, with colonoscopies, EKGs, carotid ultrasounds, mammograms, CT scans, heart echoes, and so on and so forth. The list goes on. So you might ask, well, why is there a conflict of interest with that? Isn't everybody over 50 supposed to get a colonoscopy?
Yeah, well, that was done by proclamation again. That wasn't done by good science. And the United States Preventive Services Task Force has looked at this and come out and saying, not so sure about this. Not sure we have the data to say that. So then they throw it back to the individual doctor and say, talk to your doctor and see if what your doctor thinks. Well, you really think your doctor has researched all that and has determined that indeed this is good science? Well, what your doctor has done is listened to the gastroenterologist saying, oh, yeah, this is a good idea. We should be doing it. But, I mean, that's like putting the fox to guard the hen house. And it's not like they're trying to be malicious. They're trying to do the right thing, but it's not science.
If a person has symptoms or a reason to have a colonoscopy,
that's different.
But to just do it across the board, that's the question. And that's where the conflict of interest comes in, because the doctors have this equipment and everything, mm-hmm. and their offices, they're all set up for this, and it's a cash cow.
Well, it was about 5 years ago, we reviewed this topic in detail and came to the conclusion that the United States Preventive Services Task Force did and said, this is not right. These are just proclamations. Well, where's the data?
Well, the same thing with the mammograms. We've been talking about this
under
for a long time. But
especially.
It's really, really hard to get across and get through all the brainwashings that have gone on around mammograms. So talk a little bit about the mammograms and what's going on there. Where's the conflict of interest, and how many people have to be screened for mammograms to even find something
cancer.
That's wrong or suspicious?
Well, you have to do 1,800 mammograms to help one woman who has who is going to turn out to have breast cancer. 1,800.
And how many out of those women get breast cancer from the radiation?
Good question. It's going to be between 1 and 2, because about every 12 or 1,400 mammograms, you're going to cause one cancer. And then you're looking at all the things that are overdiagnosed with the technology, especially in women under the age of 50, which is why this Preventive Services Task Force came out and said, well, we're not so sure this is a good idea. Talk to your doctor about it. And again, talk to your doctor about it. We need a policy by people who have reviewed all this, not some local organization who says, hey, mammograms are good for you, go get them.
Because and everybody just follows along like sheep. We're all sheeple.
Yeah.
And you hear about it with all the walks and all the pink washing and all the everything for breast cancer
they
to
insist.
Get those mammograms. Why aren't we hearing about breast thermography? But that's another topic,
sure.
And we've talked about that many times.
Well,
we have that
on
the website, drsaputo.com.
Well, one of the chief people, Otis Brawley, who's a fine physician, is part of the American Cancer Society. And it was a few years ago he came out saying, you know, I'm not so sure that a lot of the testing we're doing is right. And with mammograms, we should leave that up to the doctor to figure out. He was going along with the United States Preventive Services Task Force. And it wasn't but 2 or 3 hours later, after the New York Times published that, that he came back with an apology saying, oh, I didn't mean that. Because obviously what had happened is the American Cancer Society got all over him and said, what are you doing? You're biting the hand that feeds you, because what's happening here, if you want to know the true story, is that the people who have the most to gain here are not the American Cancer Society. It's the pharmaceutical industry that has a lot to do with funding the American Cancer Society, because they know that we're overdiagnosing cancer.
They can sell more chemotherapy.
Well, that's what they did. And that's a long story that we talked about a few years ago that was totally corrupt. So I have very little respect for what originally was a very good organization, that's the American Cancer Society, and today is in bed with big pharmas to the point where you can't trust what they're saying. And that's why I think when we're doing these mammograms, you know, we're overdiagnosing so many people who are scared to death that they're going to have cancer. They're getting biopsied when they don't need it. They're diagnosing too much ductal carcinoma in situ, of which 98% of these women don't die, and 2% do. And basically convincing women, especially the oncologists, that they need to have surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation. Now, that's a big business decision. And that's what's happening there. That's not a decision that's made by people who are thinking for themselves and putting women through all this unnecessary testing.
Okay. So anyway, there are a lot of tests and procedures that are overprescribed and that the doctors many times have financial interest. But what about the carotid ultrasounds? I get postcards in the mail all the time.
I know.
They've got like
free screenings, or they'll charge you $50 or some lowball thing.
They've got wagons going around to make it easy for you, because if you have plaque in your carotid arteries, those are the arteries in your neck, you could possibly have one break off, I guess, or get a clot that
That's
goes
right.
up to your brain and give you a stroke.
Right.
So why is this a problem?
Well, common sense would tell you that if you've got a plaque there, that you may have a problem that could, you know, like you said, could cause a stroke. And so these do-gooders, who are so-called do-gooders, they're coming out with these mobile vans, and they're going to churches and schools and all kinds of places and offering these tests at a low rate. Would you think they're doing that just because they're really good guys? I can tell you this is a business deal that's convincing people that they need these tests as screens. But the United States Preventive Services Task Force doesn't think that. They've recommended against these tests. They're trying to tell you that if you do those tests, what is going to happen if you're just doing a routine screen? Now, I'm not talking about people who have known heart disease or known strokes or known vascular disease someplace else. But they try to do these screens, find things that are not normal, and refer you back to their doctors to do their procedure. That's in an awful lot of money. And what the United States Preventive Services Task Force says is, that's not indicated, because what we have found when we follow those people who are going through all this, yes, done, because they're overdiagnosed, overtested, and overtreated.
Now, does this even go for an EKG? Because this is kind of a routine thing, and there's not a physical side to it. It's
Absolutely.
Not invasive.
Absolutely. The EKG is not indicated. You might want to do one baseline study on people at some age. But I remember years ago, we all would do an EKG every year. And then it turned out that people got to 40 and they all got stressed. And then we got sophisticated and started doing CT scans of the heart. And then we got to be doing body scans that look for all kinds of things. And what I mean is, it got us into trouble over-diagnosing, over-treating, and causing way too much of a problem in people who were having no problems to start with that were significant. They were like finding a red herring. They weren't important to do, and they shouldn't have been done. So the whole business of medical guidelines needs to be revisited. You need to analyze it from the point of view of what does the patient need, not what is the doctor pushing for. Anyway, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health, PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Caputo here with Nurse Vicki. We're opening up the lines at 888-874. 888-888-7448. So give us a call if you have a question about your health or what we're discussing. And now for Vicki's Nurse Vicki First 2020 Anti-Aging Tip.
Well, we had a few little station problems, so we're going to go back and talk about chemotherapy again, because some of the chemotherapy benefits seem to be overestimated, and there's question about the doctors really setting realistic expectations with their strategies for advanced cancer patients. A high percentage of advanced colon and lung cancer patients believe that chemotherapy can cure their cancer. So we're going to talk about whether this is true or not.
Yeah, well, absolutely. It's amazing sometimes that the things that actually happen in medicine that stun you. When you're talking about people who have cancer that spread, and it's stage four, so it's in different places in the body. So say it starts in the breast and it moves to your bones or your liver or your
horse. It's metastasized.
Yeah, it's metastasized. The chances of chemotherapy helping you are in the range of 2.1 to 2.3%, meaning that that's the number of people that will be alive at 5 years. And the other basically 97% of people will be dead. And yet what we're still doing is we're giving our patients a lot of toxic chemotherapy treatments and radiation treatments that really haven't been proven to be of any value. And at the same time, people are suffering from all this. So the question that comes to mind is, what do you do?
Well, the patients that were in this survey rated their communication with their doctors as excellent. I mean, they felt like they had Yeah, they felt like they had a really good communication going on with their doctors, and those were the ones that were the most misinformed. So what goes on during the doctor visit? Why is there this misconception?
Well, part of it is the doctors really want to help, and they don't want to give up, but they also won't stretch themselves beyond the limits or the boundaries of what they've learned in their medical training. They won't look at new therapies that are out there that are non-invasive, therapies that actually could work, therapies that are affordable and safe. And that's a real problem, because then what they wind up doing is either saying, go home, you've got a few months to live, probably do the best you can, sorry about this. Or they may be pushing a new drug that's out there that may cost like $100,000 a year and extend life by maybe a month or two. That's not uncommon at all.
Well, you know, we were talking about conflicts of interest earlier, and the oncologists profit from the chemotherapy. It's like one third of their income.
Well, that's right.
That just seems like it just shouldn't be.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that some doctors unconsciously are thinking about their income. You know, you wind up making a certain number of dollars, and you learn to live on that. And then when you don't make that money, it becomes a problem because your financial empire collapses. And so there's this part of you that wants to do what you can to sustain your income. That should never be part of what a doctor chooses for a treatment.
So when somebody's got stage four cancer, that's basically their pretty much of a death sentence.
Well, it is. If you look at these statistics, which are international statistics, I mean, they're published in the mainstream journals.
So why are we going to put somebody that's this sick through toxic chemotherapy to maybe shave like a few weeks or maybe a few months off of their...
Or maybe not. That's right.
Yeah, and maybe not going to help them.
Well,
and spend $100,000 on the chemotherapy and make their hair fall out and make them throw up and make them feel tired and sick and
well, that's
worse
right.
than what they already feel, and be so close-minded because they're so arrogant that we think that Western medicine is the only thing that works with the chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery.
That's right.
And they don't feel comfortable recommending that these patients can go and get some complementary alternative medicine. Now, maybe some of the alternatives might not save their life either, but there's something also called palliative care. We need to help these people to feel better and have a better quality of life while they're here, and maybe help them to prepare for when they do pass over. But how can doctors set realistic expectations without the patient losing hope
or trust
in their doctor?
Well, the first thing is to be honest. You have cancer. Most people who have cancer have this outcome in your situation. But I can't predict what's going to happen to you because you're just one person. So let's do the best we can that makes sense. Why do you think doctors themselves, the oncologists themselves, don't take chemotherapy very often for stage four cancer if they have it or their family has it?
What you just said, though, sounded so reassuring.
What's that?
To me, that's the answer of how to talk to the patient, what you just said.
Yeah, well, I mean, we have to stay focused on the patient and be wanting to help their quality of life better. And sometimes, you know, you're only a doctor. You're not God. You're not determining what happens to a patient.
And we have to help the patient to make good decisions about their care because it's their life.
Well, that's right.
And they're afraid.
Well, we have to stretch people beyond their boundaries, especially the doctors, and do more to support them than we are doing in terms of what are we going to do? There is this thing called a life cycle. And there's a lot that we can do to assist people to pass, from this plane to the next one. And if we don't do that, then people a lot of the time are going to be dying in fear and being afraid to die. And we need to do something that's different because otherwise people just going to suffer. Anyway, You're listening to Prescriptions for Health on PRN.FM. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on advice on how to avoid the flu and do happy seniors live longer is what we're going to come back with after that.
Oh, medical advice for the flu. Avoid it. Eat right. Make sure you get your daily dose of fruit and veggies and take your vitamins and bump up your vitamin C and D and get plenty of sunshine and rest. My, oh my, what a wonderful day. Plenty of sunshine. Well, anyway, take a walk. Get your exercise and get those toxins out. Wash your hands often. It doesn't count to use the toxic antibacterial stuff because that'll make you sick with something else down the road. No triclosan and get lots of fresh air. Open the doors and windows whenever possible and try to eliminate as much stress from your life as you can. Or you can take the doctor's approach. Think about it. When you go for a flu shot, what do they do first? Well, they clean your arm with alcohol. Why? Because alcohol kills germs. So, walk to the pub. Put lime in your vodka. That's fruit.
What?
Put celery in your Bloody Mary. That's a vegetable. Drink outdoors on the patio. Mmm, that fresh air. Tell jokes and laugh. That'll eliminate stress. And then pass out. That counts for rest. Well, the way I see it, if you keep your alcohol levels up, flu germs can't get you. Remember, a shot in the glass is better than one in the ass. I mean arm. Oh, my God. Did I say that? Well, I'm just joking. Alcohol is not the way to avoid the flu, and neither is a flu shot. So practice that healthy lifestyle and build up a natural immunity. Now, we were going to talk about being injected with steroids in the spine and how that can cause fractures.
Okay.
So it was in the news recently that some patients that were injected with steroids in the spine ended up with meningitis. And now a new study shows that epidural steroid injections for back pain can increase the risk of spinal fractures significantly. This sure sounds like invasive procedures can have their disadvantages, doesn't it? I mean, don't steroid injections slow healing in the first place?
There's no question. You're on the right track here, Vicki. But you've got back pain. You'll do just about anything if it incapacitates you because you can only take about so much of it. And then it becomes so frustrating that you become depressed.
Especially if you have nerve pain involved.
Oh, you've got sciatica that's going from your back to your leg. So you've got problems in your neck and it's radiating to your arms and you can't walk without pain, you can't sit without pain, you can't lay in bed without pain, and you're taking all these narcotics and other kinds of muscle relaxants. It's a terrible place to be. So
if you get this injection, it makes you feel a lot better.
Most of the time it does, and it makes sense from the point of view of pain relief. But look at what happens if you do. You know, the Henry Ford Hospital did a study that was published in this month that showed that epidural steroid injections increase the risk of bone fractures by 29% for each epidural injection there is.
So they increase fractures by how much?
29%. I mean, that's a staggering thing. They looked at 3,000 people who had one steroid injection or more with 3,000 people who didn't, and then they measured fracture rates in people who were age 66 or more. And this is what they found. So you wind up taking three steroid injections, which is not unusual at all. You're looking at a 70% increase in the risk of osteoporotic fractures.
Well, it seems like people that get these steroid injections, I mean, I could see maybe doing it once, but a lot of people keep repeating them. They really sound like they need some bone density test for one thing.
Well, I think that's right.
I mean, it's an anti-inflammatory. It helps the pain. But what are other effects can steroid injections have? I mean, they can reduce your calcium absorption and what else can they do?
Well, I mean, when you're taking these drugs, they have powerful effects like blocking the absorption of calcium from the intestinal tract and increasing the excretion of calcium by the kidney and causing hormonal changes that rise at parathyroid hormone level and increase bone breakdown. So you wind up with osteoporosis. They also decrease the amount of estrogen and testosterone that are made that are both things that are important to try and make new bone grow.
So it sounds like if you get a steroid injection, it would be good to take some supplements like calcium and vitamin D and K and strontium. And I mean, you know, you could always throw exercise in there for for strong bones, but when you're in pain like this, it's pretty hard to do weight-bearing exercise.
Well, that's right.
But so let's talk about what some of the alternatives are to these injections, what people could try first before resorting to a steroid injection.
See, there are a lot of things that actually work pretty well. The steroid injection's a quick fix, okay, but then you have this thing that goes with it that increases your risk for fractures and for slow healing. But things like chiropractic and acupuncture and body work and imagery are really things that when you use together in an integrative pain management program works great. Then, of course, we've been talking about the photon stimulator, which is the infrared light therapy that we recommend for the treatment of that. And it's really terrific at how that works to do things that that change the amount of pain that you have. The infrared light works like an epidural injection, but without the injection. So when people come to see me and they have horrible pain in almost any area that's caused by disc disease, usually we can relieve the bulk of that pain in about 5 or 10 minutes using light. The trick then becomes how to sustain that. And we can't with everybody, but then we can't with epidural injections either. So we're doing about the same thing, but non-invasively.
Well, there are lots of things that people can try that are good for back pain, like chiropractic and acupuncture, body work, physical
sure.
therapy.
Well, we
imagery.
Like to use those in combination, Vicki. So at the Health Medicine Center in Walnut Creek, where I work, what we do is we combine the infrared light therapy with all these other modalities and sometimes even use epidural injections, but not very often because they're the last choice rather than the first choice. So what we have here is something we should all know about that is important when we're looking at this integrative approach. If you want more information about infrared light therapy, go to drsaputo.com put that in the search box, put infrared light therapy, and back will come audios and videos that are short and to the point that will explain to you what it is, how it works, and what conditions it's useful for.
You can also put back pain in the search box, and you'll get a lot of tips on what to do for back pain.
Well, you can take the health assessment. If you join the site, which is 100% free, there is no charge on the site for any information that we provide. If you join, you'll be able to take one of 33 health assessments. So you want to go there and check that out.
So what's the number here at Prescriptions for Health if people want to call in?
All right, 888-874-4888.
The key to healthy aging is keeping socially active, enjoying life, and having a positive attitude. That makes a difference in longevity and also the quality of life. So tell us about this English study and about the social isolation that's linked to poor health later in life and early death, especially from coronary artery disease.
All right, so we're looking at the University College of London doing a study that was published in October, just this last October. They looked at 10,000 people living in England as they age from age 50 onwards. And what the goal of the study was is to understand the economic, social, psychological, and health issues in an aging society. And to do that, they looked at the interrelationships of things like personal finances and social detachment and isolation and health and well-being. And they followed these people from 2002 to 2011. So it was a 9-year period. And they looked at the first group of people from 2002 to 2003, with the second group from 2010 to 2011, and saw what kinds of things changed.
Well, one of the things that I noticed in this was that enjoying life is preventive medicine and predicts less risk of disability and better health. And if these people that were socially isolated that were over 50 tended to be less wealthy with fewer hobbies. Those are the ones that seem to have the most problems. People that were more active, that did volunteer work, and they had social networks, and people did better. And people that were single or people that lived in a rural area had a lot more health problems.
Right.
And mobility problems. You know, people can't get around and they have transportation problems. That's depressing and that's lonely.
Right.
And so that can affect a person's longevity.
Well, this study actually showed that over 9 years, about 20% of these people over the age of 50 died. the ones that did the best were the ones that were in the top third in terms of being happy. The ones that were the happiest, the death rate was about 10%. And in the other group, the lowest happiness group, the death rate was almost 30%. So that inner smile that we have that gives us a positive outlook makes us live longer with better quality of life.
I mean, it can increase the risk for a heart attack.
Oh, it does. There's no question. And there's more disability, more ill health. Even the walking speed, which we use as a gauge to predict how healthy people are and how long they'll live, fit into this so that it was diminished in the people who were the ones that didn't feel have that inner smile.
And what happens with stress? You know, what's that do to our bodies and our cortisone and so forth?
Well, there's no question that when we're stressed like that and we feel sad, that the cortisol levels go up. That's our stress hormone that gets us all revved up. The C-reactive protein goes up, and they measured this and found that you could actually reverse these findings by doing things that would make you have a better attitude.
Well, there really is a power to positive thinking.
Oh, no question.
And it's better for people not to take the role of being a victim. They need to do for themselves. You know, sure, it's important for family to come and visit and check on people that are isolated and feeling lonely and down in the dumps and older and so forth, and invite them out and maybe fix dinner for them and be with them, maybe just watch TV together, anything, call them, whatever. But it's also good for these same people to reach out to others too. Tell them what they need. Tell them what they want to do. Maybe invite them over. You know, they can invite them over for a cup of tea or coffee, just anything to get people over there so they're not feeling isolated. And
well, it's relationships that are keeping us going in our lives, and it's what we all want. We want to be loved and appreciated. We want to be able to love and to appreciate. And if we do those things, it makes for a lot of happiness. So it's pretty straightforward.
And some of this, you know, can even start when people are young, because there was another study talking about social rejection in adolescence and how that can have long-term psychological and physical outcomes affecting immunity and decreasing and for the risk of inflammation. And that's what's related to disease the most is inflammation.
Well, that's right.
And so even if you're young, this can carry over to when you're older and shorten your length of life and quality of life.
So what you experience as a child has an impact when you're older. And if you get a bad attitude because you've got a dysfunctional family that doesn't give you any self-esteem, what do you think is going to happen to you? That's going to stick with you unless you can get some kind of counseling or some kind of information that's going to help you change that.
Gosh, is it hot in here or is it me?
Oh, gee, Vicki, it's about 70 degrees. I'm not sweating. What's with you?
You know, menopausal hot flashes seem to be on the rise over the years.
Oh, really? Is that so?
Yes, and women in their desperation often turn to HRT, which is hormone replacement therapy, still, and they seek alternatives like black cohosh, but we have a healthy complementary alternative treatment that has a high success rate with no adverse effects. So what is it?
Well, what we've got to do is try some hypnosis, some clinical hypnosis. It doesn't sound like that's getting after the cause of things, and it may not be the specific issue that's coming up, but it may be on the other hand, too. We don't really know.
Well, I thought it was pretty amazing that they found that hypnosis can cut hot flashes by 74%. That's huge. That's better than anything else that anybody else has tried.
Yeah, and it may not have any side effects, right? How about HRT? You start looking at things like HRT, which is Premarin and Provera, which I think is an outmoded, stupid approach to treating hot flashes, because you have choices that are better than that by doing the same thing except with bioidentical hormones. Why would you want to use a horse estrogen in a human being?
Nay!
Yeah. I mean, I'm expecting some of the people who come to see me that are on this to be grazing in a pasture someplace. And why would you use something called Provera, which is not progesterone. It's an estrogen. It's a progesterone-like substance when you could use the real thing, progesterone.
Well, they used the fake one just because they could patent it, and they can't patent something that's natural.
That's exactly right. And, you know, for years what we did was we recommended that, saying, it's going to lower your heart attack and stroke rate. It'll lower your risk for cancer. It does all these wonderful things.
Now we found it just the opposite.
That was by proclamation. That was the same thing we were talking about earlier, about setting medical standards. How did that standard get set? You can bet your sweet little backside that that was because the pharmaceutical industry was pushing Premarin, and lots of interesting stories about that.
Well, you know, hot flashes are really a nuisance, and they interfere with your sleep. I mean, it's really hard for women to sleep when they're sweating all the time, and it's also not much fun if you're socializing and pretty soon your hair's wet and your face is sweating, your makeup's running and your clothes are wet and all that kind of thing, and you're trying to sleep at night. One of the things that I've heard about that seems to make a difference in increasing the amount of hot flashes is if you eat sugar and if you drink wine before you go to bed. Those are things that can make them worse. And also other things that can help besides the hypnosis, if people want to try other things too, would be acupuncture. And also some people profess that digestive enzymes are helpful. And just living a healthy lifestyle, getting the exercise and so forth. And, you know, you can talk about a healthy lifestyle and include sleep in there, but it's pretty hard to do when you're having hot flashes. But some of the things you can do is use a fan, drink a lot of water, and have patience, you know, just figure it's going to pass. And my outlook on it, because I had a lot of hot flashes for a lot of years, maybe sometimes 20 to 30 a day, was to just figure that I'd rather have the hot flashes than to take hormone replacement therapy and not have the hot flashes and then end up with breast cancer from the hormone treatment and then end up having to take tamoxifen for the breast cancer, and tamoxifen gives you hot flashes. So I'd rather just have the hot flashes and skip the cancer part.
All right, let's look at the study that was done that was published in the journal Menopause. And what they found, as we said earlier, is it cut hot flashes by as much as 74%. Now, the way they did this study is they gave these people in one group 5 weekly sessions of imagery, things like imagine it's cool, that you're in a safe place, or you're very relaxed. And then they gave them an audio tape that was basically teaching them how to get into a hypnotic state. And they were asked to do this every day. And they kept diaries of what was happening. And they also measured skin conductance, which is a reflector of hot flashes. Now, at 12 weeks, when the study was over, 75% of the people who had 75% of the people had fewer hot flashes in the hypnosis group and only 13% in the control group. Then they looked at the effect of the skin resistance. And in that setting, it went from about 50% increase or better improvement in skin resistance in the group that was getting the hypnosis, and the group that didn't, it was only 10%. So we've really got some strong data here that says that this approach that we're taking to treat people who have hot flashes with hypnosis is a solid, safe thing to do. And that's, I think, what we should be trying to do is encourage people to do things that are safe. You know, Vicki talked about lifestyle things. I mean, exercise itself, if you just do about 3.5 hours of exercise a week, it's going to cut your hot flashes rate down substantially. Not everybody benefits from it, but that's what the data shows on people who do exercise.
Well, the hypnosis sounds like a great idea to me, and it sounded like, too, that it might even improve the function of the parasympathetic nervous system.
Well, it may. I mean, we were looking at things that that all should be part of a program, and each person's different, and whichever program you want to do is the one that probably is best suited for you if your doctor knows about all these things. So what you need is a doctor who knows Western medicine cold, but also knows these other approaches that are in the integrative approach to medicine that I think we all need to do. So it's at the close of the show, so I want to remind you that we'll be back to talk live about what's new in the news and health and take your health questions every Monday morning on PRN.FM. and drsaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on PRN.FM.
If you've enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life. And remember, if you live in California, vote yes on Proposition 37 to require labeling of GMO foods.
All right. I'm with you, Vicki. Thanks for that. We'll see you all next week. Take care. We'll